From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westerveld. It's Here and Now. Robin's off this week. Today, Republican Senator and former presidential nominee John McCain issued a statement distancing himself from Donald Trump's latest comments after a weekend of back and forth between Trump and Khazir Khan, the father of a U.S. Army captain who was killed in Iraq.
Trump responded over the weekend that he was viciously attacked by Khan during his DNC speech last week. And this morning, Khan told CNN that Trump needs to work with his advisors on showing empathy.
We are the solution to the dealing with the terrorism in the United States. Join hands with good Muslims. Only war is not the solution. It is one of the solutions. Communities coming together is the solution.
Joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And let's start with Senator McCain's statement that Eric mentioned. McCain, of course, is a former prisoner of war. He released this statement today that said, "While our party has bestowed upon him the nomination, it is not accompanied by an unfettered license to defame those who are the best among us." What do you think of this? Where are we here with this back and forth between Khan and Trump and now other Republicans?
Well, look, Donald Trump has done and said a lot of things that have offended a lot of different groups and haven't seemed to matter as far as the primary went. Now, the general election is very different. We're not sure where exactly this will all go. But I'll say this. I've seen more Republicans react to this in a negative way than I've seen for a lot of other things. I mean, certainly there was the criticism of John McCain, which a lot of Republicans didn't like. But when you look at after that Democratic convention where they had all that patriotic theme going on, and then you have this criticism of Khan coming from Trump. And really, Trump could have handled it in any number of ways. It didn't have to fuel the fire, but he always tends to do that. And, you know, this is, we'll see if this winds up splitting off any of his support. I don't know that it will, but I think that he's having trouble, continuing to have trouble to reach out to those who might, you know, be open to voting for him or be unsure of him, which is kind of the whole point of conventions.
And then there are those who are not voting for him, even in his own party. We spoke with Senator Jeff Flake today of Arizona, who has been a very outspoken critic of Trump even before this latest controversy. And here's what he said.
Well, I would hope that he would come out and just say, I'm sorry. The statements I've made against this man and his family are inappropriate. I shouldn't have made them. I'm going to move on.
Are we likely to hear more of that from other Republican lawmakers? Are there people who don't want to come out and criticize their nominee? And how is all this playing with voters, Domenico?
Well, Flake is one person you noted who's not voting for John McCain. For Donald Trump. John McCain has said that he would vote for Trump, but that he is critical of what Trump is saying on this. You know, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, also issued sort of critical statements saying this is not the way that they would talk about this, but they're still supporting him. It's a very difficult line for them to walk, and certainly not what they wanted to be talking about following the conventions.
What about military families, voters? Is this is a group that, you know, typically votes Republican. Is this likely to affect that at all?
Well, what's amazing is Democrats have now been picking up on a lot of the themes that Republicans traditionally are able to push very strongly. You know, having General John Allen speak in that very fiery tone at the Democratic convention about going after ISIS, about all of the patriotic symbolism and flags that you had at the Democratic convention. You had this video that the Clinton campaign released showing her praying backstage looking somber while the Methodist prayer was happening. You know, this kind of thing is deliberately done by the Democrats to try to win over some of those Republicans who might be having second thoughts about Donald Trump and might be open to voting for Hillary Clinton, though they really don't want to. So what you're starting to see is Democrats trying to bring some of those folks on board. But like you said, a lot of military voters and veterans have been Republican in the past.
One more thing real quick I want to ask you about, Domenico, is Trump has the campaign has been bringing up problems that it has with the debate schedule, saying that some of them are slated to compete with NFL games. Are they going to change the schedule, or, you know, what will happen with this?
Well, first of all, we should say that the debate schedule was done before the NFL schedule was made. So there's that point. But the NFL schedule, you know, this is sports. You know, they make millions of dollars based on the debates on the football schedule. So I highly doubt that they're going to change it. You know, it's something that Trump has now come out and said, or his campaign has said, that he's still going to participate in the debates, though Trump is trying to say that somehow Hillary Clinton is rigging this the way, quote unquote, tried to rig the primary.
That's NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thanks.
Hey, thank you.
Now, Jeremy, the presidential race will affect many so-called down-ballot contests that will determine whether Republicans can maintain control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Republican Congressman Tim Huelskamp is in a desperate fight to keep his seat in the 1st Congressional District in Kansas. He faces a big challenge in a primary tomorrow from a political newcomer who's won the backing of the state's powerful farm lobby at Huelskamp's expense. Peggy Lowe from Here and Now contributor KCUR has our story.
Come on in. Hi, how's it going?
It's a big day in this small storefront in the heart of central Kansas. More than a dozen people have crowded into the Salina campaign headquarters of Roger Marshall. He's a political newbie who is challenging the incumbent, a fellow Republican, Congressman Tim Huelskamp.
You drove all this way. You have to get your photo taken.
Representatives of 6 farm groups are here to announce they are backing Marshall, a physician, over Huelskamp in one of the largest and most conservative districts in the country. The Kansas Farm Bureau's Stacy Forshee says Marshall visited 50 counties to win the support of the group's 40,000 Kansas members.
Dr. Marshall has shown that he has strong ties to agriculture, and he also shares a lot of all of our beliefs and values that our members do.
Marshall's beliefs and values mirror Huelskamp's on social issues. Both are conservative, opposing abortion and supporting gun rights. Those beliefs are what got Huelskamp elected in the first place. He rode in on the Tea Party wave in 2010.
A lot of our frustrations honestly started with no representation on the Ag Committee.
Huelskamp lost his seat on the House Agriculture Committee in 2012, pushed out by then-Speaker John Boehner for challenging GOP leadership. It was the first time in a century that Kansas didn't have a representative on that panel. Agriculture rarely plays a role in national politics, but farm country clout, or a lack of it, definitely is in play in this race.
When you're in Kansas, the Farm Bureau is a big dog, and you really don't want to mess with the Farm Bureau.
That's Emporia State political science professor Michael Smith. Huelskamp's absence from the Ag Committee is a big problem out here in a congressional district called the Big First, an area that covers 63 counties, 2 time zones, and has more cattle than people. Roger Marshall pledged his support to the ag industry at the meeting of farm and ranch leaders.
The entire Kansas agriculture community has risen with one voice to say enough, enough of the political games. They've risen to support our team because of the clarity of purpose to restore our representation, our reputation, and influence over federal farm policy.
The farm groups are also angry that Huelskamp hasn't supported one of the state's biggest projects, the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, a billion-dollar animal disease research facility being built in Manhattan. Another problem, he voted against the 2014 Farm Bill.
I want a congressman who won't be met around every corner with closed doors and burned bridges.
Katie Sawyer farms with her husband in McPherson County. She's voicing the other frustration that many in Kansas and Washington have with Huelskamp. They say he's just too hard to work with. Huelskamp wouldn't return several requests for comment for this story, but he has promised during campaign stops that he will get back on the Ag Committee.
It's shocking, but true. Congressman Tim Huelskamp is being attacked by the Republican establishment for fighting Obama's unconstitutional executive order on amnesty.
Conservative groups like the Heritage Foundation, which produced this radio ad, support Huelskamp's battles over immigration, against gay marriage, and his latest attack to try to get the IRS commissioner impeached. But in a new wrinkle revealed last week, some fellow conservatives have also targeted Huelskamp with their own ad.
We can't trust Washing Tim, and it's time for him to go. ESA Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Did you hear who paid for that ad? ESA Fund is a conservative super PAC with allies that include aides to GOP Senator Ted Cruz. Yet, Cruz has endorsed Huelskamp. Political scientist Michael Smith says we're seeing a further splintering of the GOP.
The question is more about a sort of an establishment Republican that is quite conservative but doesn't actually want to dismantle the government versus another creature of Republican that often acts as if they do want to dismantle the government.
Heelskamp has done his bit of dismantling, including leading the ouster of John Boehner from his speakership last year. Current Speaker Paul Ryan has stayed on the sidelines of this primary race, leaving many thinking that Heelskamp won't get his chair back on the Ag Committee. But whether Heelskamp will even get his office back is up in the air. Polls say his race against newcomer Roger Marshall is too close to call. With no Democrat on the ballot, the winner of tomorrow's primary will face a Libertarian candidate in November in a district where Republicans always win. For Here and Now, I'm Peggy Lowe.
Today, survivors of what many call the first mass shooting in modern America will mark the 50th anniversary of the tragedy. On August 1, 1966, 25-year-old former Marine and student Charles Whitman opened fire from the tower at the University of Texas at Austin. Whitman murdered 16 people in all that day and wounded more than 30 others. A local reporter captured part of the chaos.
This is Neil Spelson, Red Rover, on the University of Texas campus. This is a warning to the citizens of Austin. Stay away from the university area. Traffic is now converging on this area, and there is a sniper on the university tower firing at will. Several persons have been injured. We have no reports on whether there are any fatalities, but we do know a boy riding a bicycle has been shot and seriously wounded.
This kind of attack was unprecedented at the time. The gunman was eventually shot and killed by police. Among the survivors of the UT Tower shooting is Forrest Preece. He joins me now from member station KUT on the campus of the University of Texas, near the row of businesses known as the Drag. Forrest, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Preece, you'll be attending the ceremony today to commemorate this tragedy. What goes through your mind today, 50 years after this?
Oh, gosh. Come in here this morning, look at the way it looks, appears now, comparing it to what I was experiencing as a 20-year-old junior at UT. I'd just turned 20 on that fateful day. I had lunch, as usual, with two of my old Longhorn band pals in the Rexall drugstore right across from the campus, right across from the Student Union building. We had gotten through eating lunch, and I think this may have saved my life. For some reason, our conversation that day went on longer than usual. Mm. When we got to the cash register, the lady said that the cashier said that somebody's shooting a gun. You guys better not go out there. And so we barged right out anyway. This was 1966. People didn't know about mass shootings back then. It certainly wasn't part of my mental landscape. Any rate, we stood there. We heard some pops out from the distance, like from the main mall. And in our infinite wisdom, we thought somebody was shooting firecrackers. And, well, that guy's going to get in a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And I told my friends, oh, I'm going on. And I turned to move to my right and head south down the drag to the crosswalk in front of the co-op. And for some reason, some flash of intuition made me stop moving to my right. And about 10 seconds later, a high-powered bullet came past my right ear and hit a gentleman named Harry Walchuk, who was standing in the in front of a newsstand right next door to the drugstore. And he died about 2 hours later in Brackenridge Hospital. The reason I say I think it may have saved my life is that on most days that summer semester, I was in the middle of the main mall at approximately 10 till.
What is your view about how something that was so unusual, you thought it was firecrackers, it was unprecedented at the time, is now almost commonplace in America? We have mass shootings with alarming frequency.
It makes me so sad. What can you say about it? Gosh. And now you think there's a whole group of copycats out there that want to outdo each other. That's what just makes you crazy about it all.
Understandably, for us, this has been a difficult memory to shake, even 50 years on. How do you separate the memory of the shooting from your memories of your college experience, or can't you?
Well, you really don't. But I think all the good times I had at the University of Texas, I was on the Daily Texan staff for a while, and I was in the Longhorn Band and had so many good times there. And My wife and I have, you know, endowed scholarships and funds at UT. I'm a proud alumnus. And I enjoyed UT immensely when I was here. But no, you're right. It does tinge things with a little bit of sorrow.
And as I've read, some students and locals ran home, got their deer rifles, and fired back at Whitman. Is that accurate in your memory?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Gosh, towards the end of the thing, it was like a war zone out there. I mean, but that did prevent him. I mean, there's two sides to every story. That though, all those people firing back, and many of them were law enforcement officers. It wasn't just people that ran home and got their deer rifles. I mean, anytime the sniper popped his head up to try and fire over the rail of the or the ledge of the observation deck, at that point, somebody was going to take a shot back at him. So
it was a full-on firefight. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but it. Oh, yeah. More towards the end, it was just constant firing back. It was like a war zone.
Today, coincidentally, a new gun law is going into effect in Texas, allowing concealed handguns to be carried on college campuses. Do you think this law might have changed anything about the outcome of the UT shooting had it been in effect 50 years ago?
Or no.
And what do you think of this law?
I don't care much for it myself, but as far as changing the outcome of the shooting, I mean, he got up to the top of the tower with no opposition whatsoever, and no one would have had any reason to use a gun on him because he had subterfuge going on like crazy for him. He dressed up like a workman, had his footlocker full of his arsenal, strapped to a dolly, got on the elevator, went up to the top of the tower with, you know, he didn't present any danger.
Forrest, what do you think we need to remember about this shooting 50 years on?
Oh, gosh. Oh, what should we remember? I wish we could forget. That's what I think.
Mm. Is there anything positive to remember about that day?
Gosh, no. Mm. All the positive, well, yeah, you can say that, yes, there were a lot of positive things that were done. There was a lot of heroism, for sure. A lot of people risked their lives to go out and pull people into ambulances. A lot of people, all manner of medical personnel in Austin, Texas, dropped everything they were doing and rushed down to the Brackenridge emergency room and pitched in. Probably 1,000 people volunteered to give blood. I mean, the line at the blood bank was so long that the police had to come out and direct traffic around it. So there were many positive things that day, but I'm sure like any rational person, we wish it never had happened at all.
Forrest Preece is a survivor of the UT Austin Tower shooting. Forrest, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Certainly, Eric.
As we mentioned, the 50th anniversary of the Texas Tower shooting also marks the day a controversial campus carry law goes into effect in Texas. Today, people with licenses can carry concealed firearms on the campuses of public colleges across the state. Laura Eisenzee from Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media has our story.
Here at the University of Houston, new student orientation covers the basics of college life. Things like class schedules, academic advising, and what to do when you're sick. Now it also covers carrying a gun.
Concealed carry is you cannot see it. So bottom line is you should not see any guns here on this campus unless it's a law enforcement officer.
Sergeant Dina Padovan is with the campus police. All summer, she's told new students and their parents what they can expect from campus carry. It's one way the University of Houston is preparing for guns on campus. Padovan's boss, UH Police Chief Caesar Moore, says he doesn't know if guns will make campus safer. He's focused on making sure people know about the change.
We're past the philosophical argument of pro or con. We're at the point that the law has passed, the policy's in place, and we're implementing the law. That's what we're doing.
Moore believes the most visible change will be the new signs that mark gun-free zones, places like the daycare, special labs, and the rec center.
I don't think that the typical student will see any difference in their college experience because the typical student would not be carrying a gun.
Until now, guns haven't been part of the typical college experience in Texas. One survey finds that students in Texas oppose guns on campus 2-1.
I know, it's a place where like students can come, hang out.
We're now at the Student Center, where I met Aaron Patton. He's majoring in biotechnology.
you can carry within here and everything. To me, that's nice. I carry most places that I go off of campus. It's nice to know that I can come in, I can eat, and I can feel safe knowing that I have my own firearm on me and everything. So,
when he gets his final class schedule, Patton will check to see if concealed weapons are restricted in any of them. He plans to carry as much as possible.
In case something awful were to happen on campus, I would know that I'd be able to defend and protect myself.
Other students find no comfort in that.
To say the least, I would say I'm frightened.
Ahmed Siraj plans to graduate in chemical engineering in May.
You know, I know in Texas here, everyone just talks about how much, you know, we like our guns. But with campus carry, you know, I think that's the last place guns should be would be an environment, a school environment like the University of Houston.
Siraj has to adapt to that concept here at the Student Center, in his classes, and where he lives. He's going to be a resident advisor at the only dorm on campus where concealed weapons are allowed.
It'd be, I guess, alarming to, you know, open up a resident's room and see a gun there and then know that they're allowed to have that gun.
In that case, he's supposed to walk out and call the cops. Concealed handguns can't be in plain sight at the dorm. But they are allowed inside professors' offices at UH. And that brings us to the final stop in our tour, with Maria Gonzalez in the English department.
I teach feminist theory, and I teach queer theory. I teach some fairly controversial topics.
Gonzalez says this year she might be more cautious with those controversial topics. She also might move student meetings to gun-free zones. And she's considering something else. She may get her own license to carry a weapon.
There's a part of me that instinctively says, if you're concealed carrying, so am I.
Gonzalez has 3 more weeks to decide before classes start. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Uber announced today that it is selling its operation in China to its main rival in that country, Chinese company Didi Chuxing. Even though Uber's operation in China is one of its largest, measured in number of rides, and even though China, the world's most populous country, is a market with great growth potential for Uber. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, joins us with more on this. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
So why would Uber sell this to Didi Chuxing?
Uber would sell this because it's not winning. Essentially, this was the most important market. CEO Travis Kalanick spent so much time there, he joked once that he should apply for Chinese citizenship. Mm. It's the growth potential there is so in line with what investors were expecting for Uber to be able to achieve these huge valuations it's been getting as it's been raising money. But essentially, it's just been losing too much. One estimate is that it's just $1 billion per year that Uber is losing in China.
Why? Why didn't it work for Uber in China?
Well, it didn't work because there were already other competitors there that already had apps for hailing taxis. And so in order to get market share, it had to subsidize rides. It had to make it cheaper than these other competitors. And so that cost money, just making cheap rides. But the other thing is that because they made rides so cheap, there was a lot of fraud. One investor says that 30% of all of Uber's rides in China were actually fake trips, things that people did to take their family members along. Or there would be forums where drivers would say, please, you know, sign up and take a ride from me so I can cash in this money from Uber. So they were losing just a ton of money trying to get market share.
And there's also a story here about how difficult it can be for Western companies to just do business in China with the regulations, with the government, with corruption in many cases, to appeal to the Chinese consumer. We've heard about Yahoo, eBay, Walmart, and other companies either pairing up with Chinese competitors or withdrawing from the Chinese market. How much of that plays into this?
That definitely played into this. And that's the thing about being outcompeted there. The competitors that they were up against, as focused as Uber was on China and developing relationships with regulators and expanding its markets in all these cities, there were companies there that just knew it better and were able to just keep Uber from taking too much market share and not get too much of a foothold in the country, as big and promising as it was.
And as part of this deal, this sale, Uber will remain a big investor in Didi Chuxing, correct?
That's right. Right. So Uber China is going to keep operating, but it's owned by Didi Chuxing. Uber has a stake now in that company. And Travis Kalanick, the CEO, actually has a board seat on Didi's board, but the other way around, too. So Didi's CEO is now on Uber's board as well.
Is Uber likely to do this to basically pull out of other countries as well?
So this is going to be really interesting. What do they do since they've been losing there and losing money there? What are they going to do? The big question is Uber just...
She's 24 years old and already retired. Shawn Johnson, as many Americans remember, was the sprightly 16-year-old gymnast who charmed the nation at the 2008 Olympics, winning a gold medal on the balance beam as well as silver medals for the team, all around, and floor exercise competitions. For a teenager from Des Moines, Iowa, it sounds like a dream come true. But for Johnson, the return home didn't go quite as she imagined. She struggled with her newfound fame and, for a time, an eating disorder. Today, Johnson is a confident mentor and body image speaker, and she's on her way to Rio to watch the U.S. Olympic team compete there. The opening ceremony is this Friday, so let's chat with Johnson today as we begin a series of conversations at Here and Now all this week with medalists about life after the Olympics. Shawn Johnson, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to 2008, because you've said that despite winning a gold medal at the Olympics on the balance beam and three silver medals, you still felt devastated. You didn't come home feeling like you were on top of the world, as everyone assumed you were. What was going on then?
For me, it was always this, I don't know, I had so much pressure on me and so many expectations going into the Olympics that I was going to walk away with four or five Olympic gold medals. And for me, I just kind of felt like I'd come up short and had a void when I left. And I don't know, for me, it just, I was really proud of myself, but I felt like all the media was saying that I had failed.
Wow, you still felt a void after winning so many medals. You felt like you should have run the table on gold there.
I don't think I felt like I personally had a void. I felt like I had, I don't know, almost a world-inflicted void because the media and general public, I guess, convinced me to believe I should.
And it was really hard to tune that out and focus on yourself.
Incredibly difficult. It's, you know, the world kind of against you, and it takes a lot of effort to, I don't know, to tune the world out.
You were 16 years old, correct?
Yep. Sophomore in high school.
Tell us about the first year after Athens and what it was like being home and how you adjusted to that post-Olympic world.
Coming home from the Olympics was crazy. I, you know, believed all the way up into the Olympics that I was going to return home, return back to high school, go back to, you know, my normal everyday life and just be a normal teenager. And I kind of got slapped across the face afterwards with just chaos and reality that wasn't going to happen, which is awesome. I had so many opportunities and great things that I got to experience, but it was a whirlwind.
Chaos, whirlwind. You were just a teenager and you were adjusting to this new celebrity life.
Hmm? Yes. Nothing can prepare you for it, but, you know, the demand for interviews and appearances and travel was crazy right after the Olympics, and it was exciting, but it was something that was new to me and something I was kind of sorting through and learning how to handle.
And did you ever feel like, I didn't ask for this, I'm just a teenager, let me hang out with my friends and text and have fun?
Yes and no. I mean, it was a huge, huge blessing. I felt like I had been gifted with the celebration and praise and respect of all the hard work I had put in. So that was really exciting and awesome. But I was a teenager that didn't know what to do with my life. I feel like every kid goes through confusion. And for me, you know, walking off an Olympic stage with a gold medal and being thrown into a Hollywood lifestyle and, you know, trying to sort everything out and figure out the business world and what I was going to do with school and college and everything. It just was confusing. I just hadn't had a second to breathe to figure out what it is I wanted to really do.
So when you were living these two lives, as you put it, how did you adjust or handle that confusion, or did that just become the new normal for you?
Over time, it kind of became my new normal, but adjusting to it was just sorting through all of the opportunities, learning what I liked and disliked and what felt good for me and what felt true to me. And, you know, over the course of years, I kind of guided my path into something that I was truly passionate about and excited about.
For a time, you considered a comeback for the 2012 Games in London. Tell us what happened.
I was skiing for my 18th birthday and took a fall and tore everything in my knee and needed my first surgery ever. And I remember thinking to myself, what if I could never do gymnastics again? And for me, my challenge to myself was never to go back to the 2012 Olympics. It was just to get healthy again and to kind of rehab my knee. And through that process, I kind of got the bug and tried to make the team, but my knee just wasn't having it. So retired about a week before Olympic trials with another knee injury. And it was disappointing, but I don't know. I don't feel like my heart was in it by then anymore.
Tell us about that moment that you decided you were done with gymnastics. Was it a tough moment?
Yeah. It's really difficult for any elite athlete to kind of give up the one thing they've devoted their entire life for. So it was challenging and emotional and, you know, deciding to kind of put aside the one thing that I knew I could succeed at was scary, but it was also liberating because I got to finally turn the page and go to the next chapter.
Since then, you've written a book, you've gotten married, you have turned the page. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's exciting.
And do you feel like you've successfully adjusted to life after the Olympics and after being an elite athlete?
I think so. I feel like I'm, you know, learning every day and making new goals and challenges every day for myself. And I can honestly say I'm happy. I'm content. I'm excited. I'm, you know, to a point where I no longer feel like I have a void with gymnastics. I've kind of filled that void with other hobbies and interests.
Like what?
A ton of different things. My husband, being a wife. I working with young kids, mentoring them. I do public speaking. I'm a personal fitness trainer. I'm a part of a ton of really powerful campaigns that kind of promote body image and, you know, good-hearted topics of conversation.
Yeah, one of those ads is for Dove soap that has been praised for its advertising that promotes a healthy body image for women. Tell us about that series of new ads.
Yeah, it's an incredible campaign. It's by Dove, and it's called Have Your Say, or it's hashtag My Beauty, My Say. And it's basically just trying, you know, there's this huge trend out there that people want to just rip apart women for their looks and their body and their appearance and their so-called beauty instead of actually, you know, critique them or bring them up for their skill and talent and ability, especially in athletics. And I went through it, and I'm trying to make sure, you know, with Dove that we can not have the next generation have to go through it. I feel like they critique every female athlete that way. I remember competing and reading more headlines and titles and articles that talked about how I was stocky and muscular and not the stereotypical gymnast body. And it frustrated me so much because I had worked so hard to be respected for my skills and, you know, to read these articles that didn't even mention it. It was frustrating as an athlete.
So reflecting on all that, what advice do you have for girls and women who might feel the pressures you do heading into their Olympics in Rio?
I would say, you know, for every girl, whether you're an athlete or not, I feel like in your respected field and with who you are, not to let people change your appearance because they have an opinion that doesn't, you know, coincide with yours. And don't let anybody change you. I feel like the strongest and most powerful thing any woman can do is be true to who she is.
And I understand you're about to head to Rio to the Games. Tell us about that.
I am. I'll be in Rio commentating for Yahoo. I'll be doing all their, like, digital content and following the gymnastics competitions and Team USA.
Sean Johnson is a former Olympic gymnast, a gold medal winner, and the author of Winning Balance. Sean, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We've heard a lot of political speak in the past 2 weeks during both party conventions, back-to-back speeches claiming each party's candidate as the right choice for America. But they also highlighted another difference between the parties: language. Derek Thompson of The Atlantic writes that Democrats and Republicans today speak with entirely different sets of vocabulary, even as they talk about the same issues. Derek is with us now, as he is each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jamie.
So explain what you mean by that, that they use different language.
So we're all familiar with old-fashioned political polarization, the idea that Democrats and Republicans are sharply divided by ideology, by policy, and getting more divided each cycle. Less obvious is that there is linguistic polarization as well. Republicans say radical Islamic terrorism, while Democrats say extremists. It wasn't always this way. A new study that I wrote about in The Atlantic looks at political speeches over the last century and a half to measure partisanship, which in this case is defined as the ease with which a listener can guess the speaker's party just by listening to the word choice. And this definition of partisanship scarcely changed between 1870 and 1990 for 120 years. But then suddenly in the 1990s, rhetorical partisanship exploded, and it's still rising. So Democrats and Republicans now are like that famous line about Americans and Brits. They are divided by a common language. They don't just disagree about issues. They use entirely different vocabulary to discuss those issues.
Well, and I want to get to what changed. But first, let's give people a little example of what you're talking about here. These are two clips from the last two conventions, voices from the two major parties. I'm not going to say beforehand which one's which, but I don't think it'll be that hard for you to figure it out. Listen here to the first one.
We also must recognize that evil does exist in this world. The threat from radical Islamic terrorism is real. Our troops don't care what party you represent. They care about having the tools, training, and equipment to be able to do their jobs.
Okay, so that's one. Here is another.
About 11 million undocumented immigrants live, work, pay taxes, and raise their families in the United States of America. A lot of their families include U.S. citizens just like me. But listen, no matter what your family tree looks like, a fair immigration system is better for all of America.
Okay, so if you're keeping track at home, that second voice there was a Democrat, Luis Gutierrez, a representative from Illinois. And the first one was Daryl Glenn, U.S. Senate candidate in Colorado, Republican. It's pretty obvious there, listening, when they use terms, Derek, like undocumented immigrants, which Democrats like to use as opposed to illegal immigrants, and then
right.
Republicans using the term radical Islamic terrorism.
In particular, this term radical Islamic terrorism has become essentially a Republican marker. You don't have to look at anything, the R or the D after the name, to know that obviously somebody saying this is a Republican. And it goes to this idea that since 1990, you have had both parties build their own lexicons and then teach upcoming politicians to use those same words over and over again. So you don't see Democrats at the DNC saying illegal aliens, and you don't see Republicans using these terms that Democrats use about you know, tax cuts or tax hikes and tax increases.
They don't say taxes, even they say revenue. We're going to raise revenue,
right? Exactly. Exactly. And I don't think that it's good that Republicans and Democrats are essentially building these entirely separate worlds to talk about issues that affect the entire country.
Well, and the other one that comes up a lot, people comment about it, is that Republicans won't even say Democratic Party many times. Now they say the Democrat Party.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I haven't even picked up on that. I mean, there's all sorts of subtleties to this that, you know, different people will probably pick up on depending on how much news they watch. But it is not subtle. I mean, it is explicitly all about preaching to the choir. And it speaks to the fact that you now have a country that is so divided that elections like this year in 2012 and 2008 become less about trying to get that mythic swing voter and more about turnout, trying to make sure that you get everybody who agrees with you to show up at the polls in November. member. And so as a result, you are speaking explicitly in terms to that audience, not trying to persuade people. And this is not a good thing. It speaks to the fact that we are polarized not only by ideology, but also by language.
And when a voter hears from a politician of their party, they can say, you're speaking my language. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
And before we close out this hour, we have to say goodbye to someone who you don't hear on the radio, but his hands are in almost everything that you do hear on this show. Ethan Lindsay, our senior managing editor, is leaving us. Today is his last day to become the managing editor at KQED in San Francisco. Now, Ethan has been an amazing part of our team, always going the extra mile to get that interview, to make sure that we're bringing you the most compelling, interesting, fair-minded programming possible from all over the country and all around the world every single day. It is not an easy task, but Ethan does it very well. He fights the fights that need to be fought, but also has been a wonderful presence behind the scenes. And not just because he's always got candy at his desk. Mm-hmm. He has made it more fun every day to do this show, and he's made us all proud of the work. Ethan, thank you. We'll miss you, and best of luck. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. See you in San Francisco, Ethan. You're listening to Here and Now.